You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast designed to help you save your marriage no matter where you are, even if you're at the beginning trying to figure out how to make sure you're at a good start, which is a lot of what we're going to talk about today, how to avoid those tough places, but also when your marriage is already in trouble. And that's also what we're covering today as kind of a reminder of how you might have gotten here and what to do from here. So today we're talking about what happened to the dream. After years of working with couples who are at various stages in their marriage, I've worked with couples before they got married to get them ready to get married. I've worked with couples who were literally on the edge of divorce. In fact, some on the way to sign their papers. And I've worked with couples who are actually in pretty decent relationships along the way. And so I've been able to watch what's happened along the way. And there's one thing that stands out above everything else. No matter how the relationship is going, there has been a shift in the expectation. In other words, what people thought they were walking into is not what happens. So as I've noticed it, after talking with probably hundreds of couples before they got married, there's not a person that's come into my office that expected their marriage to be in trouble, that expected their dream marriage to die. Not a single person, which tells me that we all walk into a marriage expecting it to go well. We all expect we're going to beat the odds, right? And in some ways, the odds are a little tilted. There's been a lot of talk about the fact that 50% of marriages are going to fail. And it's not quite that. It's below that. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 45% of marriages will fail. And that takes into account the fact that every time somebody remarries, their chance of success in a marriage begins to drop in that particular marriage. So second marriages are far more likely to fail than first marriages, and third marriages are far more likely to fail than second marriages, and on you go. So what we're talking about here is basically whether your relationship is going to work or not. So nobody expects that to happen, even with the fact that we all know people who have failed. We all have parents or family members or friends that are in the midst of a failed marriage. So it's not like we don't know what's out there. We just don't expect it's going to happen to us for a couple of reasons. One is we always assume that our love is different, you know, that we have the real thing, that we have what it takes. And the reason we base that is because we see the feelings we have and we see the feelings people don't have when they're at the end of a marriage. What we don't notice is that at the beginning of a marriage, a lot of people share the exact same feelings, but we assume that our love is different. We also assume that we're going in well aware of what's going on. You know, we assume that we're not walking in having missed some things. And so we always assume that we have met the right person, that we have the right relationship. It's the right time in our life to get married. And that only makes sense. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it. So the fact that people are stepping forward in a relationship, in a marriage, means that they think that they have the pieces in place and that they're going in wide-eyed, that they're able to see all the dangerous points. Here I was sitting on the other side of that, listening to couple after couple coming in, knowing that A, in a premarital session, they weren't going to listen much to me, and B, knowing that they were missing a lot of data, a lot of information. And it wasn't that that data was going to be destructive to the relationship as much as that data was going to surprise them when it popped up. And so part of what I was always trying to do is prepare couples to get help sooner, not later. I was not thinking that I was making everybody so self-aware that their marriage was going to go well. We already know the statistics on premarital counseling, and the statistics are premarital counseling doesn't do much to stop marital problems. What it does do is it gets couples okay with seeking help. They've already talked to somebody, so they're kind of used to that. And so all I was trying to do was make sure that they knew how to get in touch with me or somebody else down the road when they did hit the rough spots. Not if, but when. Because the fact is that 100% of marriages have problems. 100%. Somewhere upwards of 50% decide to figure those issues out and work through them. Okay, and the other piece that's true is that nobody expects their marriage to die and their relationship to die because they assume they won't let it die. They are committed to, you know, making sure that they nurture that relationship and spend time together and take that quality time and ways of loving each other. In fact, they're so convinced of the fact that they figured out how to love each other that they don't know what happens when that doesn't pan out, when they don't know the best ways of loving that other person. It's just an assumption that's made in the fact that at the beginning of a relationship, we're throwing everything, all our ways of thinking and talking about love, we're throwing that all at our spouse, trying to win them over. And at that point, we're still in that place of not realizing that maybe there's some piece of that that's hitting and others that don't. That's what Gary Chapman talks about, those love languages, when those love languages are so important, because in the beginning, we're just doing them all. You know, all five of the love languages that Gary talks about, we're doing them all, just trying to cover the bases. And so then we assume that we have that down, only to be surprised when that there's just not time for that in life. And so we haven't kind of figured out the exact way of speaking. So here's the reality. I love the term that Gary Chapman uses for this. It's the tingles. We have that infatuation feeling, that in love feeling that we think is just so different for us than anyone else. And the fact is, there is a biological preset to that time frame. Research shows that that's not going to last more than 2 years, and that's the most any couple's going to get out of that. Now, sometimes we can nurture that and find some ways of reviving that, but the feelings we have in the beginning cannot biologically go on. We kind of fry that system when we do it. That feeling of what we call madly in love. Well, if you look at the brain referencing, you know, when they do the scans of a brain in love, it is lighting up the same pleasure centers that are lit up when somebody is on an addictive substance. Not only that, but it has some of the characteristics of somebody who is deludedly mad, deludedly crazy, has some delusions of reality. Those same places in the brain are all lit up because we're madly in love. Our body is creating this place of feeling of love, but eventually our body kind of returns to a normal place. And that's a really good thing because we all have to get back to work. We all have to continue kind of building civilization. Otherwise, civilization would have long fallen apart and people would be stuck in their house, just the two of them glommed together, constantly having sex and loving on each other, and nothing else would happen. So it's a kind of a biological preset that those tingle feelings are going to go away. And that's okay. That's just the normal state, unless you don't know that. And so many people in our culture are surprised when that happens. When those feelings begin to change, they think they must have made a mistake. They think something must be wrong. They can't figure out why their spouse has changed so much and is no longer that person that brings them those butterfly, lovey, tingly feelings. Now, I don't mean to say that there's a life devoid of that as much as to say that there is a change in that. It's what Bob Grant and I talked about when we were talking about the switch from an adrenaline-based attraction to an endorphin-based attraction. The adrenaline-based is what causes those tingles, the butterflies in your stomach. You notice those butterflies are the same ones you feel right before you get on a roller coaster or right before you walk on a stage to do a public speaking event or right before something else happens. It's an excitement in your gut that only feels good because you've decided that's the tingles, the butterflies that a spouse gives you. But in reality, at that point, probably not even a spouse. In reality, that's just a normal reaction to the body of infatuation, of adrenaline-based attraction, which is infatuation. When it switches, sometimes people are surprised, but what it switches to is something much more powerful, but only if people know it's coming. See, I have this belief that what we do in our culture is that we send people out from a marriage ceremony with some vague idea of what they're trying to do and no specific directions. It's kind of like we say, okay, now you're married. Now go figure it out while you're on the job. And a lot of times the missing pieces of that information are things like your feelings of attraction, your feelings of connection are going to change. That doesn't make it bad. It just makes it a normal switch. But when we don't know it's going to happen, we're surprised by it. Not only are we surprised by it, but we begin to believe that something is now wrong because this wasn't supposed to happen to us. Okay, so when that happens, when our brain calms down a little bit, when our body calms down a little bit, something else happens. imperfections emerge, we begin to see that our knight in shining armor or our lovely perfect princess is not so perfect, that we all are at our core human, with human foibles and fallacies and shortfallings and shortcomings and all the other things that make us interesting as humans. So that person that we thought was our perfect person is not so perfect. And that's okay too, because either you're going to become disenchanted if you didn't know that was coming, or you become very interested in this person, because somebody who has their faults and foibles is much more interesting than that perfect image that we hold of somebody. Suddenly they become real. Notice how often in our culture that we have this love for the superhero, forgetting that one of the things we love about the superhero is the vulnerability of the superhero. That there has to be some vulnerability that makes them human and a little less than perfect and a little more approachable. And so a spouse that has some imperfections as they emerge, we can either become disenchanted and say, wow, you fooled me, or we can say, wow, isn't it interesting how we're not quite who we portrayed? And isn't it interesting that I'm not quite the person you thought I was, that now I can bring my humanity to the table, that I can be real? And that's kind of a relief for both people, at least when you know that's coming. If you think there is some perfection that has to be there, then the relationship is at risk, because you go, wow, you are not who I thought you were. There must be other problems here. Okay, then a third thing happens, and that's the difference between our implicit and our explicit priorities. You see, we have two sets of priorities that run our life. One is what we would say is our priority, and the other is what we do that is really our priority. So we might say that our marriage is our priority, that our spouse is our priority, but when job comes in, when career comes in, when maybe training comes in, you know, med school, law school, graduate school, all those things come in, when kids enter the picture, when family events happen, our parents or our siblings get sick and we have to go take care of them, when there are outside interests, you get interested in running a marathon or a triathlon or take up golfing or do those other time-consuming events, or you have friends that begin to encroach on that. And it's not that we shouldn't look at our career. It's not that we shouldn't look at further training. It's not that we shouldn't pay attention to our kids. It's not that we shouldn't take care of family members. It's not that we shouldn't have external interest in hobbies. And it's not that we shouldn't spend time with friends. It's how we pace that. Do we begin to let go of our connection with a spouse in order to do that? Or do we protect the connection with the spouse in order to keep a balance? Because the most important relationship in our adult life is our spouse. The way our spouse goes is the way our life will go. The way our spouse goes is how our family will go. And as we begin to work around that as a priority, as the primary relationship, then the other pieces of the puzzle fall into place. This is not about time. It's not about counting how many hours you spend at work and how many hours you spend with your spouse, or how many hours you spend with your friends and how many hours you spend with your spouse, but how you prioritize that. Are you making sure that you fed your primary relationship before you go feeding all the other priorities in life? That includes kids. Okay, so then there's this battle between our implicit and our explicit priorities, and oftentimes our explicit priorities begin to win the day, and our implicit priority of a relationship begins to fall to the wayside, partly because we didn't keep our eyes on it. We just assumed that that would happen, just assumed that everything would be okay. We say we're getting married and everything's okay. And then we aren't static. That's the really interesting thing about this whole thing. We aren't static as humans. Humans are always constantly growing and developing. As much as we fight change, we are always changing, even at a cellular level. Within 7 years, your body has entirely replaced itself, and really the majority of your body is replaced every 2 to 3 years. There's not a cell in your body that in 7 years won't be a different cell. So you are changing on a cellular level. More than that, your experiences grow you and change you. More than that, life and getting older changes you physically, and your maturity and your wisdom level, all of those things are changing, and yet we believe that things should be static. So we have this changing place in our lives where our spouse begins to change. And if we don't stay connected with our spouse to the changes, our spouse is surprised by how we change and we're surprised by how a spouse changes. The changes generally are invisible to us. We don't track our own changes. We just know that we're this person who wakes up, and I am this person. Even, you know, when I read a book and it changed how I view the world, or maybe I saw a TV show and it made me change the way I see the world, or maybe I watched a movie and it changed how I see the world, or maybe I read an article somewhere or talked with somebody and something changed me. But I don't notice the change so much because it happens gradually and internally. But our spouse can see huge changes and doesn't know what happened. And the same with us. We're going, what happened to you? Why aren't you that person that I knew last month, last year, 10 years ago, a decade, 2 decades, when we got married, whenever that was? And it raises the question, who are you? Who is this person that I'm waking up beside? Sometimes it can feel in a marriage that's gone on a while that there's this stranger beside you that you no longer know. Oh, and then there's one other thing that happens. The fifth thing that happens is that life happens. Illnesses come our way. Injuries come our way. Life changes come our way. We become parents and that changes things. We hit a midlife crisis and that changes things. We hit retirement age and that changes things. Our kids go to college, it changes things. Every step of the way, life is happening. And because of that, where we are in the relationship is happening, especially when we haven't attended to those changes. So what do we do? What do we do at this point when you've changed, your spouse has changed, the relationship has changed, maybe the priorities have gotten off? Well, I believe that there are 4 things that have to change. You have to reimagine, reconnect, redirect, and reinvent. You have to reimagine where your life is, to recognize that there's been a change, and reimagine where life is going, both for your own life and the life of your relationship. You have to reconnect. You have to find some ways to get back to that place of what really and truly nurtures any relationship, connection. And so when we can do that automatically in the beginning, we sometimes lose track of doing that later on. And so we have to get back to the skills of reconnection, learning how to be that important person for a spouse, learning how to find the best ways of showing love to a spouse, learning how to reconnect with each other as life changes. Each life transition brings a new possibility of change, a new place, a new direction, and requires us to learn how to reconnect with that important person. Then we have to redirect, make sure that we're directing our life energies in ways that bring us back to the relationship. If we just allow those explicit priorities to carry the day, our implicit ones will always fall to the side. The ones that we have in our head are different than the ones that we act out. So we have to redirect our life and our life energies so we're back to what's important to us. If we consider our marriage to be back, do we redirect energy back to it? If we consider our kids to be important, do we redirect energy around there, but balancing it with a spouse? And how do we reinvent? How do we reimagine this relationship as something different than it was before? Here's the thing about a marriage. It's becoming a we. And people don't recognize that because we don't do it anywhere else in life. Now, there are some hints about that. Early on, perhaps in your wedding ceremony, there were some hints about becoming a we, about one flesh, all of those words that we bring from religion, but we really don't listen to. It's about being a we, so we have to reinvent and really become that. When marriages really get to that place where they're working on being a we, they don't get into trouble. When they're connected in ways that are about being a we, they don't get into trouble. Marriages get into trouble because they don't know that's the goal, don't know they have to work on the connection, and then don't know what to do when they're no longer feeling it. So we have to reinvent the relationship. Okay, those are the pieces you do. You have to reimagine, reconnect, redirect, and reinvent. All of those are crucial pieces of the puzzle. If you need help on specifics on how to do that, I talk about that. That's what I cover, how to become a we. It's a pretty big subject, and how to connect with your spouse. That's a huge subject, and I talk about that in my Save the Marriage system. If you don't have that Save the Marriage system, it is the cornerstone of reimagining your life, of reconnecting with your spouse, of redirecting back to where it needs to be, and reinventing your relationship so that the dream comes alive again. If you don't have it, you can find it at SaveTheMarriage.com. This is Lee Balcom wishing you the best as you reinvent your relationship.
You've You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.